CKUT 90.3 FM. It's a little bit past 6 o'clock, and this is In the Motherhood for July 20th, 2022. I'm your host tonight, Robin Fadden. On today's In the Motherhood, we're sharing two interviews from radio show Wings, and big thanks to Wings for making great content that is shareable across community radio. And those pieces of radio, one of them is called The Mother of Motherhood Studies. So very apt for In the Motherhood, which is a feminist radio show about parenting. That's us. This episode of Wings is about Dr. Andrea O'Reilly's research about motherhood and bringing it forward as a new academic discipline. She's saying that subject of motherhood is, of course, as old as humans ourselves, and it actually evokes controversy in academia, including within women's studies. Thanks for listening to CKUT.
Today on Wings, the Mother of Motherhood Studies.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Dr. Andrea O'Reilly is a full professor in the School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at York University in Canada. In 1997, she broke new ground in her field with a project called the Motherhood Initiative. She demonstrated the academic viability of this topic, publishing many scholarly periodicals, anthologies, and books, and hosting many conferences around the world. I'm Frieda Werton. In 2011, I interviewed Dr. O'Reilly about how and why she established Motherhood Studies.
Can we talk about some of the organizations that are applying mothering theory?
Or? Yes. I mean, in the book, The 21st Century Motherhood Movement, Mothers Speak Out on Why We Need to Change the World and How to Do It, and basically making the point that we need a feminism that is mother-centered. I coined the term, for better or for worse, matricentric feminism. Not ever to imply to replace, you know, mainstream feminism in its various configurations, but I do believe that women are oppressed in patriarchal cultures. They're oppressed as women, but they're also oppressed in ways quite unique to them being a mother. And so sort of identify what that specific oppression looks like if you're a mother, but as importantly, to also think about how mothering can be a place of power for mothers. And I think in our culture, and Adrienne Rich talks about this at length in her book, Of Woman Born, the irony, or more appropriately, the tragedy, is that the very thing, for lack of a better word, that gave women historically power was their motherhood identity. But that very thing now has been misused and used against them. So it's about reclaiming the maternal power that has been taken from us, but taking it back in such a way that empowers us and the work we must do as mothers, right?
Well, yeah, it is very strange, actually, that sort of the judo that was performed on feminism mm-hmm. was that women got the right to work, but also we lost, because wages fell, mm-hmm. now two parents have to work
yes.
To make as much as, proportionally, as one parent mm-hmm. used to be able to make. So we haven't made any gains there, but we've lost the ability to spend, of either parent, to spend
yes.
as much time with the children.
Right. And again, this is not feminism's fault at all, but I do think we live in a culture, and any mother or any thinking person would agree, that completely, you know, devalues mother work. They don't see it as work. Well, it's not work. It's not paid. We live in a culture, of course, that value is determined by monetary measures, and because mothers are not paid for the work they do, they're not seen as working. And I think that's gotten worse over the years. And we've becoming increasingly in a neoliberal world, in a material world, that worth is even being more determined by your paycheck than I would say 20, 30, 40 years ago. And to compound that, as you said, now households require two incomes. And the thing that troubles me is that I do think for some women, there have been huge gains since the rise of feminism. I mean, largely privileged, you know, middle-class, white, able-bodied women, that if you can live as unencumbered and disembodied and talk and walk like the boys, then you can really benefit from patriarchy. If yes, of course, not completely. We still have violence against women. We still have battering, of course. But I think when you become a mother, motherhood is encumbered and it's embodied. And in our culture, only, you know, those who do not have that can compete as so-called equals with men. And the reality is that women still do the majority of childcare, home care, domestic labor, and I also call it community care. They're the ones who, you know, keep the neighborhoods running. I also call it like emotional care. They're the ones who make sure, you know, an aunt Sally falls down and breaks her leg, that flowers are delivered to the hospital, and somebody makes soup for when she comes home. So women, you know, have a first, second, third, and arguably fourth shift, and that hasn't changed. So that, for me, that's people always say that feminism, you know, feminism has stalled, and why? And a lot of people have said it's because of motherhood. That motherhood is the unfinished business of feminism. I think it's partially true, but I think the unfinished business of feminism is men, right? That's where we need to make social change. You know, we have to redefine mothering as a social good, as something that has to, it's required, and all have to do it. So now women today, yes, they have to behave as unencumbered, individualistic citizens in the workforce, and then come home and do all the encumbered work of maternal care. And men get off the hook, you know?
Well, I do think that in the last decade or two that the younger fathers seem to be assuming more of the parenting obligations and the pleasures of parenting.
I think so. And I always joke to my students, in my days of despair, I need to remember that. But I still think what's happening, and I don't think I'm alone in this, I draw really from Sarah Ruddick's work here. I think that women, though, are still doing the psychological work of mothering, the emotional work, what Sarah Ruddick calls maternal thinking. They're the ones remembering, planning, organizing, anticipating, you know. So I always say if the, you know, the woman has to remind her partner to get the bag of milk on the way home, delegation does not equality make. And I think a lot of households, men are doing a lot of FaceTime. They're at the park with their child. But the woman is still keeping the household in her head, who has to go to the doctor's appointments, you know, or, you know, their daughter, 12, is not eating. Ooh, do we need to be worried? Is she suffering from anorexia? I mean, kind of keeping all that going on, that men, and I've done a fair bit of research on this, and as has Andrew Doucette from here in Ottawa, that men really don't do that emotional, intellectual work of mothering. They put in the FaceTime, but I think that's what most women say is exhausting about mothering, particularly when it's combined with paid work, because it's completely unbounded. You know, it's a job that never ends, mothering. So you're lying in bed at 3 o'clock morning, worried about your child or planning an event. And that type of stuff, I think, is what's catching up and causing a lot of burnout with women. It's not so much the work, though that's hard, but that kind of intellectual, you know, holding the household in your head, that can't be downloaded. And I don't think men are sharing equally in that sort of maternal thinking. And that part, until there's truly that shared intellectual labor of raising children, I think we're going to still be stuck.
Well, how do you think that that might be brought about?
I think by doing it. I mean, I really believe that mothering, there's nothing natural about mothering. I don't think there's anything inherent. I was a young mother, unplanned, 22. Somebody asked me a baby, and I said, you got to be kidding me. I had never held a baby. I didn't know anything about mothering, and I thought it was a joke. I said, you're letting me take this 8-pound baby home. I became a good mother by doing it, and I didn't have my mother near me. She lived in another city. I learned the hard way. I wouldn't advise that either, completely on my own, isolated, but I learned. And you see this often with men who have full custody or men who are widowed. They become completely competent doing that stuff I'm talking about, that maternal labor, intellectual labor, because they have to. And I always say to my students, I say, my advice is have men involved from day one, and have them involved in such a way where the woman is completely absent. Like I say to my students, you need to go away for a week, maybe ideally two, and you don't do anything. You don't prepare the meals. You don't iron and lay the clothes out. You don't organize the kids' schedules. You walk out. And you know what? By the second or third day, and he can't call his mother either, though. That's also the part of it. He has to do it. And you know, I know many men who are completely involve equal parents because they're doing that real work, not just the fun stuff on Saturday afternoon, the FaceTime. So I really think that men are as competent parents as women, but they just don't have to, because, you know, women are telling them how to do it and, you know, where to do it. And I think if you just step back, men will figure it out like every woman on the earth has figured it out.
Right. Now, what about the larger society and the way all the resources are being pulled out from under most families? so that mothering becomes sacrificial, you might say. Mm-hmm. Are you going to eat, or are your child going to eat? You know, these things.
Oh, I completely agree. I mean, I write about this and talk about this in my teaching, and Demeter Press will be publishing a book on this. I believe that neoliberalism, the rise of neoliberalism, has probably been the death knell for mothers, because there's been just a complete removal of any type of, you know, societal, governmental support, complete emphasis on individualism and, you know, self-reliance, and everything's been downloaded to the family. It's now your own fault and your own responsibility. And I do think that's a huge problem. And I think we're going to realize it even more in retrospect. I think we're going to look back and go, oh gosh, you know, we can see it happening in the 80s and 90s. I do believe we're in a crisis situation with families because they are completely unsupported. And absolutely, I mean, mothers need support to raise children well, and families need support to raise children well. And it just puzzles me and frustrates me that they don't get that. It, you know, they're always say we love children and children are our future and they're going to pay our pensions and all this empty rhetoric. But they don't support families to raise the children that they supposedly, you know.
What kind of support would government ideally, or perhaps in a normal society, offer?
Yes. Well, I think we have certainly models. For example, we can look at Quebec. I mean, their child care program has been hugely successful. Yes, I've heard criticisms of it and justified ones. But quite on the micro level, I read in the Toronto Star just last week or 2 weeks ago, a large report, and I want to see the whole report, this was just a summary of it, that it has paid for itself. It, because of the increased wages of those working women who are now back in the paid labor force, who are paying income tax, and according to their books, it is a self-sustaining program now. So absolutely childcare, you know, good funded, non-profit childcare. Also, definitely, as I said earlier, though I'm a bit ambivalent about maternity leaves, I think we have to have extended parental leaves. And certainly public and social policy that recognizes care work as a social good. So whether that be sick leave for family, I don't even like the term sick leave, I like sort of family leave or whatever you want to call it, personal days, that we are not just workers, we're human beings. And I think everybody should have a personal day or two a month. And if that means taking your car in to be fixed or taking your pet to the vet or taking your child to the dentist, you know, we are human beings and we have to run our lives. And we have to understand that. And I think in the past we were able to do it because we had wives doing it. Men had wives to pick up their dry cleaning or, you know, do whatever. These wives are now working in the paid labor force. So all this work of running households is just now hanging in limbo, but it still needs to be done. You know, so I do think we have to understand that family work, childcare, is not a private individual thing. It's part of the larger social fabric. So even just a change in perspective, then I hope would change policy.
Well, let's talk about the effect of motherhood studies as something that may eventually change policy. Mm-hmm. How did motherhood studies get started, and what is it like now?
Yes, I mean, we started using, I mean, I actually coined, I think, in 2006, the term motherhood studies. And maybe it should have been mothering studies or maternal studies, but that name seems to have stuck, motherhood studies. Basically, I really see motherhood studies as very parallel to women's studies. There was a recognition of an absence. So with women's studies in the 60s and 70s, women were not being included in your history course or your sociology course or what have you. And women recognized that to make that happen, they had to, you know, create a discipline of their own. Certainly when I began my work in motherhood in the 90s, early 90s, I actually did a quite involved analysis of curriculum here in Canada, a little bit in the States, and motherhood was not on women's studies curriculum. I mean, it was quite alarming, and what was even more alarming, they didn't even realize it wasn't there.
I think that probably relates to the absence of motherhood from the entire academy.
Exactly. Yes, you're absolutely right. I'm doing a research project now, a Shirk-funded one. I've just finished my interviews. I interviewed 70 mother academics across North America, and I had my children, you know, 20 to 25 years ago, and things are not better. The academy is so hostile to mothers. It's more hostile than any other profession. Academics have fewer children than architects, doctors, lawyers. It's quite alarming, actually. And so there's been a lot of thinking about why that's so. But yeah, motherhood was completely invisible. So the people who are creating new knowledge, researchers, teachers, were not mothers. So understandably, they didn't include it on their curriculum. So an average intro to women's studies course would have violence and education and sexuality and work, all important topics, but you wouldn't find motherhood. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't see the M word mentioned in a women's studies class. Now that has changed somewhat, not as much as I'd like to, but I do believe it's become an independent field. And sort of like women's studies has its own, you know, body of knowledge, traditions like must-read theorists or canon of, you know, the thoughts, and they have debates and they have different perspectives, just like women's studies does. So I think it's been around maybe 10 or 15 years now. Then we can see it as an autonomous, interdisciplinary discipline, very similar to women's studies.
Who would you say are the must-read theorists in motherhood studies?
Oh, the must-reads. I would definitely say Adrienne Rich, who I believe is the mother of motherhood studies, who published A Woman Born in 76. Sarah Ruddock, most definitely, who unfortunately passed away last March. Her concept of maternal thinking. Earlier, African-American, for example, Patricia Hill Collins would be a must-read. More contemporary, Fiona Green, who's here at the conference here. She's a Canadian scholar of mine. I do think it's a growing field. So I actually published a book 3 years ago called Maternal Theories, The Essential Readings. And it basically has 50 chapters. And I say to somebody, if you want to know what motherhood studies is, this is the book to dip from. So Mary O'Brien, for example, is in it as a Canadian contributor. And it just basically goes from 1976 to contemporary. Ariel Gore, for example, who does stuff on Hip Mama, is in it. And a fair number of queer and lesbian, Catherine Arnip, for example, here in Canada. So I try to make it as much Canadian and American, and to cover, you know, 30 years of maternal theory from different perspectives.
Is motherhood studies actually making inroads into universities? Are they making spaces mm-hmm. for motherhood studies? Is it mostly in the women's studies departments, or how is it manifesting in academies?
I think there are sort of these kind of interesting independent courses. We're publishing in July, this month, I guess, the third edition of a booklet we do called Teaching Motherhood. And it's a collection of syllabi on motherhood, or reproduction more generally. And we actually have courses that are from anthropology. I don't want to say zoology, but anthropology to women's studies. And yes, it's in all the disciplines, you know, psychology, anthropology, history, health, obviously social work, poli-sci. So they're kind of these clustering of courses in our syllabi. I think we have 50, so not a lot, but that's still not bad. I mean, these are just sending out on email. If you teach a course, send it to us. So they seem to be housed in different places. I don't think they're more in women's studies than not. In fact, I think there may be still less in women's studies. Most of motherhood studies courses are coming from other disciplines. So they'll have a motherhood studies course in anthropology. Right. I actually gave a talk in January of this year. I went down to a university in the States, and it was sort of an anthropology course that was a special topic one, you know, fourth year seminar, and the special topic for that year was motherhood. So they seem to come under the special topics, you know, in literature or something, you know, the special topics, mothering literature. So I think it's still interdisciplinary. I don't really think it's based yet in any discipline, and I would say less so in women's studies. Women's studies has a very ambivalent relationship with motherhood, and I think it's getting better, but it's still fraught with tension.
Yeah, I think that the women's studies often feels that they're just clinging to legitimacy by their toenails,
yes.
And that the patriarchy is breathing down their neck.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think, understandably, there is nervousness because motherhood, and what I talked about in my talk today, you know, I think the distinction between motherhood, which Rich theorized as oppressive, patriarchal, understandably, feminists wanted no part of that. But I think what happened is, I use the expression, threw the baby out with the bathwater. It's not mothering that's the problem. It's how we're expected and told and regulated to mother. But I get that. In the early 70s, motherhood was oppressive, as it was represented and lived by most women. So there was a real nervousness. And the other thing, too, that I think there's such nervousness around what we call essentialism in women's studies. We want to see gender as constructed. We want to ignore the body. And I'm very nervous about any claims that women are indifferent, because that's suicide, right, for women's studies scholars. That's what's been used against women forever. And so I think there's a real dancing around motherhood because it's seen as always oppressive, which I don't believe it is, and it's seen as essentialist, which I don't think it is. But I see how women's studies professors get very nervous how that could so quickly be turned against and used against them. That there's all, and I may add that majority of women's studies professors aren't mothers. I mean, that's just the way it is. Now, there are some, but there are fewer women's studies professors that are mothers than other disciplines, in my experience of interviewing. I mean, you'll find more mothers in history or in sociology than you'll find in women's studies. I don't know why that is. I mean, I think part of it is feminism. But it's interesting. And I'm not saying women's studies, certainly in my experience, my department has not been hostile to me at all. They've been hugely supportive. But I've heard other women's studies scholars have had less than reception to the work they do. They keep it in the closet. They don't talk about their motherhood research.
Well, in your talk, you were talking about some of the criticisms of arguments about motherhood.
Mm-hmm.
You said emotionalism was one, essentialism was one.
Yes.
You just talked about. You want to just mention what the other ones were?
Well, yeah, I think emotionalism is an important one, too. I mean, it ties in with the other ones because motherhood activists have often used emotive strategies. And the criticism is coming from feminists and others, but feminists, early feminists, and early, I mean, early 2000, because the motherhood movement's only been around for maybe, I mean, in an organized way, you know, 5-6 years, you know, so it's very, very new. So we can't really talk about it because it's still forming. But early criticism of the motherhood movement was that it relied on emotion as a, for the strategies. And they saw that as irrational and, you know, unpredictable, and they called it, you know, politics of grief. It's a club nobody wants to belong to, i.e., you know, mothers against gang violence who've lost their children to gang violence. And that's what I probably take the most offense to, because all activism is motivated by the personal and the emotional. Of course it is. That's why you become an activist, right? Because something in your life has angered you or your child or your partner. And I just find it so interesting that only motherhood organizations have been brought to task for their emotionalism and their too personal. And yet the civil rights movement, environmental movement, peace movement, they've all been founded on feelings and thought, you know, as much as thoughts. So this critique of emotionalism has really been quite devastating to the motherhood movement. You know, they want to be prepared rational and orderly and composed. And so, and I don't think so. I think, and I think the organizations in my book have demonstrated that a lot of this emotionalism, yes, is felt, but it's also very deployed strategically. You know, they use it strategically to get attention, to get an audience, to get sympathy, and then they got them where they want them, and then they become these, you know, the more militant activists. The other criticism is embodiment, that maternal activists have really often positioned their protests or strategies through the body. So the example I gave in my talk, for example, the Argentinian mothers, when they were protesting the dictatorship, you know, they would wear placards, life-size, of their children's on their bodies, right? Marking their memory, like their children could not be forgotten. The mothers acting up are quite flamboyant, performative group, and when they march, they come out on stilts, and they dress up, and they, you know, very colorful, very performative. Likewise, code pink. Whenever they're the peace activist group, mother, they only wear pink, and they come out with pink boas, and they deliberately, you know, inscribe their body so that they can't be ignored, right? So they're very visible. And if you're coming out on stilts in a march, somebody's going to pay attention to you, right? You're very visible. So a lot of these organizations, you know, they don't deny the body. In fact, the activism is expressed in and through the body, both through marches and, as I said, sort of these very embodied forms of protest.
And your own solution to that was somehow to combine everything?
Yes, whatever works, works. There's a multitude of strategies to draw from other activists. And so if you have to play a good mother, if that's what you have to do, you do it. I mean, you don't believe it, but you do it to get the media interview or to get the appointment with the politician that you wish to speak to. So I say that women often play normative motherhood. Oh, I'm a mother, please listen, I just love my child. Well, yes, that's all true, but they're doing it, I think, very strategically to get the audience, to get the attention, to get the media attention in particular. Like the mothers of Argentina said, nobody's going to run a mother down with a tank. They're not going to. And so people say, well, that's co-opting, and well, if it works, it works. And these women they were very political. They might have acted like good, pious mothers, but they didn't stop there. You know, they were extremely radical and militant and public. So I do think that mothers are really redefining activism. It's both private and public. It's both rational and irrational. It's sort of both, you know, intellectual and embodied. And I think that they're really defining the meaning of activism. And I think they're making a lot more joyful too. I think there's a lot of, I don't want to say fun, because a lot of these are very sad organizations that have, you know, lost children to gun violence or police brutality. But they're doing it very in a, I think often very much like third wave feminism, in a very performative, very public way that is more, I don't know, I can almost say colorful, that they're really claiming space. They're not, you know, they're in a way that's very, I keep saying performative, just that they're...
And maybe you could say expressive.
Expressive, yes.
Because you can express yourself,
yes.
That's fun.
Yes, exactly, yes. It's expressive. And they can do it all these kind of really crazy, playful, ironic ways. And I think it's neat. Like, the example I always use, and I know there's a lot of controversy around Slut Walk, but I think Slut Walk has been one who's embraced that kind of performative, in-your-face, expressive, we're going to play with concepts. And I think the motherhood movement is quite similar to the Slut Walk. They're kind of using tropes and then reinventing the word, right? Saying, okay, yeah, I'm so-called a good housewife. Well, just watch me, right? I think deconstructive strategies.
I have to say that I think that was what was so fun about the women's liberation movement in the 70s, too, that maybe this has always been the strength of the women's movement.
Yeah. Every feminist I know has a great sense of humor. We're all fun. We play hard. We work hard. But there's this really negative view of feminists of being angry. And, well, we are angry. But there's this real negative. And I don't know where that comes from. Because every feminist organization rally event I've been to, it's been a blast, right? So I don't know where the stereotype has come. So I say to my students, what are you talking about? Have you ever been to any of these events? Well, no. And I said, well, how do you know then that they're these strict, you know, serious... I mean, yes, of course, some of them are when we're dealing with very tragic things. But I think even in then, there's a sense of camaraderie and joy among the women. One woman who's in the organization, she started an organization, Mothers Against Trafficking in Humans, and lost her child to human trafficking. And obviously, you can imagine how tearful her talk would be. But I've never met a woman who has such a sense of humor and such joy and such passion that you're listening to her and you're crying, but you're simultaneously laughing. That her ability to take tragedy and try to use it in a transformative way. And I think that's what a lot of these motherhood organizations do.
Well, I think this is the most radical thing that I've seen in a very long time, the motherhood movement. I think it gets right to the core of the anti-human trends. And how they must be stopped.
Right, and I was interviewed earlier today, and I mentioned in my talk as well, what frustrates me probably more than anything is the view that motherhood is apolitical, that when you become a mother, somehow you've sold out, gone over, you're not a political person anymore. And I think, where did that come from? Motherhood is the most political place it can be, both in the way we raise our children. I'm very proud to say I have three feminist children, all in their 20s, I think my best accomplishment. You know, I'm very proud to say that both women's studies major. My son's off to start his PhD at McGill in human trafficking. So I'm like, wow, I can say that's I've done well. I mean, I don't take all the credit by any means, but I think we can really raise a different generation of children. But also, even through our mothering, we can find power as our women. Because so many mothers have told me it's when they became a mother that they felt for the first time in charge, angry. You know, I'm not taking this anymore. And I don't know what it is, like, I do know, but I think it's complex, that motherhood really can, really radicalizes women and politicizes women, or at least it can. And I think it's really a place where we can, you know, make change. I'm not saying the others aren't as good, but I do think it's untapped. There's globally over 80% of women become mothers. And we don't have 80% of feminists, okay, unfortunately, in the world. So if we can use motherhood, make all mothers feminists, then we can change the world.
Well, if anybody can, you can.
Oh,
Andrea O'Reilly, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Okay.
Andrea O'Reilly is the founder of MERCY, the Motherhood Initiative for Research and Community Involvement. She publishes Motherhood Scholarship through Demeter Press. To hear this program again, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose scholarship posits mothering as the paradigm of the gift economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Werden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
That was an interview borrowed from Wings with Dr. Andrea O'Reilly talking about the study of mothering. Next up is an interview about Indigenous climate action, and it's with the executive director of Indigenous Climate Action and a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta. And she's talking about being a spokesperson for Indigenous people who are opposing corporate pollution and demanding formal representation at climate talks. One of the reasons why I'm playing this on a show about parenting is that we've seen a rise in climate activism and outrage among parents in Canada, in the U.S. and around the world, really. And I am actually a part of a parent climate action group here in Montreal called Pour Nos Enfants Montréal, For Our Kids Montreal. It's also part of a broader national organization called For Our Kids. You can Google that, and you can also find the Montreal group on Facebook. So I welcome you to listen to this interview about Indigenous climate action here on CKUT 90.3 FM. Thanks for listening.
Today on Wings.
80% of the world's biodiversity exists within recognized Indigenous lands and territories, and 85% of the world's conservation and protection zones are adjacent to or within Indigenous territories. This is not a coincidence.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
The American Public Health Association held its 145th annual meeting in 2017 from November 4th through the 8th in Atlanta. The theme was Creating the Healthiest Nation, Climate Changes Health. Keynote speaker was Ariel Chekwe Durange, a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta, Canada, and a leader in the Indigenous Tar Sands campaign. She addressed 12,000 attendees, mostly from the U.S., but also from 40 other countries. I'm Melinda Tuhus with Wings. I attended the conference and recorded Durange's keynote address, presented here.
Thank you. Eklanete. Dene sotlene. Arielse ekwe husye. Durange betziani hesli. My name is Arielse ekwe Durange, and I'm a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. And I want to thank Dr. Benjamin and the APHA for bringing me here today. I would like to start by acknowledging and giving thanks to the original peoples of this land and territory, the Muscogee Creek and the Cherokee peoples. I would also like to acknowledge the fact that these people were forcibly removed from this territory in the 19th century and now reside in Oklahoma. I would also like to acknowledge the generations of African American slaves that built the state of Georgia. Indigenous people exist everywhere across the globe. We represent approximately 5% of the global population, and roughly 370 million worldwide are recognized as Indigenous. We represent over 5,000 distinct groups with our own languages, political, social, and education and institutions that are recognized in over 90 different countries. What's really interesting is that Indigenous people's territories, our lands, occupy 22% of the world's land surface. That's in comparison to cities only occupying 3%. I find one of the most intriguing statistics is that 80% of the world's biodiversity exists within recognized Indigenous lands and territories, and 85% of the world's conservation and protection zones are adjacent to or within Indigenous territories. This is not a coincidence. This is because our identities, who we are as Indigenous peoples, is intrinsically linked to the places where we live. Not only are Indigenous peoples protecting the biodiversity of the planet, but these areas also overlap with gigatons of carbon sinks critical to climate stabilization. It should also be noted that a number of independent nation states with seats at the UN have less territory and smaller populations than some indigenous populations here in North America. Yet we still struggle for recognition. Yes, it's changing. The United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples was passed in 2007, and it was created in partnership with Indigenous peoples who had a seat at the table, making it the only UN convention that Indigenous peoples had a part of forming. However, and it also creates the foundations for one of the only documents that supports the self-determination and models of free, prior, and informed consent for Indigenous peoples. However, it's not retroactive. The history of the United States is one of real atrocities. In order for us to find collaborative ways to move forward, we're going to have to look back at our collective history. Indigenous peoples used to number in the millions, and now in the United States, it's less than 5 million people are recognized as Indigenous. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz states, "Those who seek a history with an upbeat ending, a history of redemption and reconciliation, may look around and observe that such a conclusion is not visible, not even in utopian dreams of a better society." The history of the United States and Canada alike is one of settler colonialism, rooted in things like white supremacy, African slavery, and policies supported by the church and the state of genocide and land theft. These systems attempted to demonize, devalue, and extinguish Indigenous peoples' languages, political and cultural structures, and ideological perspectives and way of life. All of this with the end goal of erasing us from the landscape and human consciousness. Now is the time that we abandon patriarchal and colonial ideologies rooted in things like the doctrine of discovery, terra nullius, and manifest destiny. We have always been here, and we were never discovered.
You're listening to the keynote speech from Canadian Indigenous activist Ariel Duranger at the 2017 American Public Health Association's annual meeting in Atlanta.
I can talk about that because my mom's American, but I do live in Canada and I'm a Canadian citizen, so I digress. I come from this territory. I come from a place called Treaty 8 in northern Alberta, where in Canada, Indigenous people represent about 4% of the population, or 1.4 million people. My people are known as the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, which is a colonial name. Our real name was the Kaitale Dene Sotlene, which means the people of the willow, which gives reference to the Athabasca Delta in which where we're from. But more importantly, I want to discuss what it means to be Dene. Melissa Daniels and a member of my nation stated that the word Dene, when translated, is broken down into two words, De, meaning flow, and Ne, meaning Mother Earth. This encompasses an understanding that we as Dene people flow from Mother Earth, and we are people of the Creator and creation. The land is the very essence of who we are. It nurtures our bodies, our minds, our cultures, and our connection to our role on this planet Earth, Mother Earth. I want my children to know what it means to be Dene. I want this picture and these experiences of mine not to be relics of the past, but something to be celebrated by future generations. When I look at this photo, I can remember the smell of the prairie grass and the sounds of the drums and my language being spoken. I want those memories to be cherished and shared by my own children. But that is all being threatened right now because of global climate change. Humanity is facing a global crisis. Climate change. Indigenous people are not only threatened by the colonial ideologies and policies to eradicate our civil and human rights, but our very cultures and our identities are threatened by man-made climate change, precipitated by colonial ideologies rooted in things like capitalism. We're witnessing coastlines rising, floods, out-of-control forest fires, and species disappearing, changing weather patterns. And it's these impacts that are being disproportionately felt by communities least responsible for climate change and those that are most vulnerable in society, like communities like my own. We must find solutions that recognize the fundamental rights of all people to create a just future. We must discuss the drivers of climate change, not just the solutions. My community now lives in the township of Fort Chipewyan, which is a northern fly-in community in northern Alberta. Fly-in means that the only way in and out is by plane, unless it's winter, for 3 months of the year you can drive, and in the spring and summer, which is about 4 months of the year, you can take a boat. This requires our people to rely quite heavily on traditional food sources, hunting, fishing, and trapping. But right now, my people's lands and territories is under threat from the largest industrial project on planet Earth, the Alberta oil sands. This is not your sweet conventional crude oil. It's thicker, like peanut butter, and at room temperature, when it's extracted from the ground, it's almost as hard as a rock. It has a relatively higher concentration of nitrogen, sulfur, and heavy metals. And it's the pace and scale of this development that makes it out of control. 10% of the world's oil reserves exist in my people's traditional territory. 10%. Over 96% of Canada's total oil reserves are contained within the traditional territories of the Dene, the Cree, and the Métis people. Dr. David Schindler, a renowned biologist in Alberta, stated, "There is nothing on this planet that compares with the destruction going on there. If there were a prize for unsustainable development, the tar sands would be a clear winner." Currently, over 900 square kilometers of land have been disturbed for tar sands mining. Over 4,000 square kilometers have been leased out to projects right now. Currently, the industry uses 170 billion liters, not million, billion liters of water, fresh water, every single year, and this is only expected to increase. This fresh water ends up in toxic tailings ponds that now cover 260 square kilometers of land, held in place with some of the world's largest earthen dams. Not concrete, not plastic, earthen dams. And since operations began, more than 1.3 trillion liters of tailings have accumulated in these tailings ponds. That is enough toxic tailings to fill up 400,000 Olympic swimming pools. The dewatering and the contamination of these ecosystems is a threat to the security, food security, and livelihoods of my people. And every day, these toxic tailings leach into our river systems, contaminating our water systems, contaminating our foods. However, mining is not even the only accessible method. The other 80%, because 20% is mining, is in situ. And in situ is similar to fracking, in so much that you steam and you put pressure into the ground. And in this case, we're superheating fresh water and diluents or solvents at high pressure, injecting them into the ground to melt the bitumen so that underlying pipelines can suck it back up and ship it off to refineries. In the end, in situ operations require more energy and generate 2.5 times as much greenhouse gas per barrel than mining operations. But industry says they do use less water. So the reality is these projects are actually leaving a larger environmental footprint than open pit mining, taking up 80% of the land of the 140 square kilometers of land, 140,000 square kilometers of land. These projects now represent 31% more emissions than the average conventional crude oil, and they're the fastest single growing emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in Canada. They create more emissions than all the cars on the road combined in the country, Canada, not the United States. And they stand as a barrier for us meeting our climate commitments. In addition to creating massive amounts of emissions, they're also destabilizing and reducing the potential of carbon sequestration and releasing stored carbon into the atmosphere. Dr. Rebecca Rooney, a biologist who trained under Dr. Schindler, conducted a study in 2012, oil sands mining and reclamation caused massive loss to peatland and stored carbon. We're reducing the ability of this land to sequester carbon by in the thousands and thousands of metric tons annually. But reclamation, industry says, oh, we love the landscape, we love the environment, we care about the future, and we'll reclaim it. And to add insult to injury, to date, less than 0.02% of all tar sands operations have been certified reclaimed. We have lost generations of use of land because of these operations that began in the 1960s. There are over 5,200 leases in the region. And this isn't one company, this isn't one place, this isn't one big bad guy. It's every multinational corporation in the world. 80% of the world's oil and gas is actually state-owned. And the other 20% is open to private sectors. And of that 20%, half of it is in my people's traditional territory where we have no say over how they're going to utilize this land. We have created the largest industrial project on Earth with hundreds of billions of dollars invested and infrastructure that touches coast to coast to coast to coast of the entire continent of North America with international and national interests from across the globe. It has created a situation where small nations like my own of less than 2,000 people are pitted up against large multinational corporations and government and economic interests that we have no chance of fighting. The battle over the tar sands has come down to a fundamental right to exist as indigenous peoples and a climate-stable future versus corporate and capitalistic rights to develop. This continues models of colonization through the industrialization of our lands and territory that exacerbate global climate change. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. Tar sands don't just exist in Canada, they exist everywhere. And Canada's this G8 country that is supposed to be setting the standards. We're in the COP23 right now, proudly talking about how we're going to do everything we can to meet the global climate commitments. Yet here we are, a G8 country setting the standards for what it means to develop bottom-of-the-barrel oil and gas, what it means to meet climate commitments, what it means to respect and implement Indigenous people's rights. My country has a moral responsibility to do better so that we do not see this type of oil developed across the globe.
This is Ariel Chekwi Durange of Athabascan Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta and a leader in the Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign. She spoke at the November 2017 American Public Health Association annual meeting in Atlanta.
Climate change alone is expected to threaten the extinction of approximately one quarter or more of all species on land by the year 2050, surpassing even habitat loss as the biggest threat to life on land. We are a species on planet Earth, let's not forget that. Indigenous peoples we are raised to know that we are a part of everything, that the moose and the caribou and the eagles and the fish are our relatives. They are our cousins, they are our ancestors. We have no more rights to anything than they do. And we are seeing both habitat loss and climate change impacting some of the most critical species in our territory. My territory, which is also home to UNESCO World Heritage Site called Wood Buffalo National Park, is home to the last wild flock of whooping cranes. That summer, and breed in my territory, and then winter in the Gulf Coast. So they're like getting it on both ends. And they're threatened. Woodland caribou in our traditional territory are not just being threatened by industrial development, they've reduced by over 80% since the year 2000 when the big boom in the oil sands took off. And now they're being threatened by climate change, reducing their food sources. We're seeing less moose, we're seeing less waterfowl. All of these things threatening the ability for Indigenous peoples to continue practicing their subsistence lifestyles, their daily and cultural activities on the land. In addition to habitat loss and climate change impacts, our food sources are already threatened by contamination and degradation caused by the tar sands industry. The picture of the ducks. In 2008, a flock of over 1,600 ducks landed on an open tailings ponds because, I'll remind you, 260 square kilometers of land are now open tailings ponds, mistaking it for an open lake, and they all died. Fish in downstream and surrounding bodies of water are now seen with deformities and high levels of contaminants. And the picture on your far left is a beheaded bison. As new people enter our territory for employment, we're now seeing that they're not just coming here for employment, but they are coming there with the same mentality to take whatever they want and devaluing the cultures of indigenous peoples. And we are seeing overhunting and trophy hunting and the desecration of our lands and species. This bison was found by one of the community members. And when he found this bison, he cried. This is a sacred animal that is only hunted at certain times of the year and has the potential to feed 4 families for an entire season in a community that is fly-in and depends on these food sources. Colonization isn't something that's happened. It's happening today still. As we see the disappearance of our food security caused by both the drivers of climate change and climate change, we're being forced to consume Western foods that are only available at the single grocery store in our community called the Northern, where a gallon of milk is almost $17, where a loaf of Wonder Bread is $8, where produce is both lacking and, when available, overpriced. This is leading people to being unable to afford good, healthy food. And we're seeing implications of real health challenges in our community. It's also forcing us to participate in the very economic systems that are destroying our lands and our food security. And this, of course, ultimately has impacts on our health. We have lower life expectancies. We're seeing increases of obesity because of bad food choices, diabetes because of bad food choices. We're seeing autoimmune diseases, respiratory diseases caused by climate change and the drivers of climate change. And what's even worse is our communities is dealing with some of the worst kinds and cases of cancer, where we have seen 6 cases of bile duct cancer that are linked to the contaminants found in the oil and gas industry. We are literally dying. We are dying so that people can have oil and gas. I'd like to ask you a question. Who thinks is our biggest client for this oil? Who? America. You guys. The United States of America is our biggest client. More than ever, we need to move towards decolonizing not just the environment, but decolonizing our solutions. We need to challenge our own systems and look for ways to incorporate and work with Indigenous peoples and the knowledge systems that they have held onto for millennia. Indigenous peoples are exercising our sovereign rights to implement our own environmental and health infrastructures, to regulate and enforce our own laws within our lands and territories, as defined by the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Articles 3 and 10. We are our own experts. We are doctors, biologists, scientists, educators, and we have the fundamental right to exist and build our own systems in partnership with our settler partners. And a lot of people ask me, well, what does decolonization mean? Decolonization is about the return of and connection to land. And decolonization isn't just for Indigenous peoples, it's for all of us. We all need to return to the land. The land houses our medicines, it houses our water, it houses our food. It literally gives us life. And we must find ways to return to those places to find the answers for climate change. It's been recognized the world over that Indigenous lives and livelihood model some of the more progressive and successful low-carbon lifestyles. Moreover, Indigenous peoples have been critical to the protection and preservation of some of the world's richest biodiverse regions. But we have to move past the rhetoric that we are agents of change. The 2 pictures here are from Paris in 2015 and Copenhagen in 2009 at the climate negotiations. And there's not much difference between the two because not much changed in there. Indigenous people still don't have a seat at the table in climate negotiations. We still don't have a seat at the table in making and proposing solutions to address climate change. We need to move past this. We need to find ways to integrate knowledge systems. Indigenous peoples are at the front lines to challenge both the drivers of climate change and pushing for the solutions. It's easy to forget that Indigenous communities have faced centuries of systemic oppression that has robbed us of our ability to easily enter local and national and international forums where policies and decisions are being made that affect our rights and survival. As we all attempt to find solutions to work together, we must address the root causes of climate change, the drivers, and the policies and oppressive policies that have got us to where we are today. Our people have the legal and moral authority to stand up and challenge these systems, and we have a deep spiritual connection to this place we call Mother Earth. We need to make sure that we don't just support communities across Turtle Island that are challenging the drivers of climate change, but also find ways to look at our own work and our places of privilege and push back and look for ways of integrating decolonized methods of research and partnerships and put an end to the colonial practices that have left Indigenous peoples and people of color on the sidelines. The world has come together to create the Paris Agreement. And even within the text of the Paris Agreement and its decisions, it contains important references to Indigenous people's rights that can help drive change at the local level where it's needed most. And that's because the former president of the United Nations even stated that Indigenous peoples interpret and react to the impacts of climate change in creative ways, drawing on traditional knowledge and other technologies to find solutions that society at large can replicate to counter pending changes. And our communities are already doing that. We're taking models of Indigenous cultures, lives, and lifestyles, and trying to find energy solutions that work. We're combining Western science and Indigenous knowledge to build energy security and sovereignty, and not just capitalist energy models. We're looking for solutions that respect our relationships to the land, and we are living proof that anything is possible. I just want to end it with, if we leave traditional ecological knowledge and Indigenous peoples out of the discourse on climate change and climate solutions, it's a recipe for disaster. If our communities are not active participants in creating pathways for a just future, we will continue to be oppressed and play a marginalized role and further divide our connection to land and this place on Mother Earth. It's time for world leaders and leaders like yourself in this room to decolonize our research, to look at our role in the health sector and allow Indigenous knowledge and peoples, Indigenous peoples and their systems to be incorporated into our work and allow us to find solutions that respect Indigenous peoples as their own leaders for self-determination. Right now, my colleague Heather Milton-Lightning is at the COP23 in Bonn, Germany, and she took this as a quote from the forum yesterday. Indigenous peoples are here to change the rules, not abide by them. I want to change the game so that my children have a chance. Climate may change our health, but it also presents us with an opportunity to start anew. Let's carve a pathway together for a climate-stable future and an equitable future for all. Thank you. Masi Cho.
That was Ariel Deranger, a member of the Athabaskan Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta and a leader of the Indigenous Tar Sands Campaign. She was the keynote speaker at the 2017 American Public Health Association annual meeting in Atlanta in November. I'm Melinda Tuhus for Wings.
Ariel Deranger is Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action. For news of their work, visit indigenousclimateaction.com. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org, and please visit our page at facebook.com/wingsradio. Wings thanks our supporters, including Jinx Houston, Carolyn Byerly, your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
That was an interview with the Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action and a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation of Northern Alberta, talking about Indigenous opposition to corporate pollution and formal representation at climate talks. This has been In the Motherhood for July 20th here on CKUT 90.3 FM. My name is Robin Fadden. You can email us at inthemotherhood@ckut.ca anytime and let us know some ideas for shows, if you'd like to be on the show, or anything you'd like to say. You can also find us on Facebook at CKUT-InTheMotherhood. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to CKUT.
Welcome to Amandla Radio here at CQUT 90.3 Montreal. We are doing a rebroadcast tonight of a show that appeared or played absolutely 1 year ago after the arrest of Jacob Zuma, the former president of the ANC, led to a large, well-organized uprising that was very violent and put down with great difficulty. And so we got Dan O'Mara to do the analysis of what was going on in the ANC and how it had come to such a sorry state. So stay tuned to this rebroadcast.
Good evening and welcome to Amandla, 1 hour of African current affairs brought to you in English and French here on CQT 90.3 FM. We are still broadcasting from the comfort of our homes, hoping to get back in the studio soon. I'm here with Doug, and we just had an absolutely amazing conversation with Dan O'Mara. He's a South African. He was a longtime militant of the African National Congress. Went on to become a professor of political science at UQAM here in Montreal.